Michael Vlahos is professor of history at the U.S. Naval War College. His views are his own. He's looking at the new national security strategy and thinking about it in context, not just of history, Michael, but of where we will go in the future. And it strikes me that as we look at the current national security strategy, it's like many documents in that it is a snapshot in time. A year ago, a national security strategy wouldn't have included any of the elements that we're fighting in the Middle East, except it certainly wouldn't have included anything about the Islamic State. And so am I correct to interpret the national security strategy as a snapshot of where we stand in February 2015, Michael? Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Francis. The national security strategy, like any of these consensus documents, requires so much massaging and so much coordination, which is the term of art used in any kind of enterprise involving lots of different government agencies and departments, is really just what you say, a snapshot for that moment in time, but it's also probably as unchanging and enduring a document as one could conceive, because in cultural terms it represents something that everyone can sign off on, that everyone demands a say in, and that thus reflects a kind of more generalized consensus about what we're doing with our military forces in the world.
When you look at the document that is just been released recently from the White House and the Pentagon, what do you see in the national security strategy that's particularly noteworthy for us, Michael?
The most noteworthy element in such a vanilla document is the kind of bland status quo vision of what America's tasks in the world should be and how we should proceed to address these tasks. And it's not focused as a traditional strategy document would be on particular threats and the way we're going to address them, but it kind of paints a high-level approach to managing the world system, and it kind of itemizes the various missions that we will undertake and activities that we will fulfill in order to maintain the world system as it is. And the only part in it that looks like a traditional military strategy, like World War II, and you have a mission, you have objectives, you're going to meet those objectives, and you're going to do that by pursuing this course of action and that course of action. None of that's there. It's really just a kind of statement of all the good things that we'd like to do in the world and how we can make the world as it is today better, but with the underlying assumption that what we're already doing in the world is what we need to do, which is to manage it. And it's kind of also a shotgun approach in that it includes everything and hits everything, as it were, in terms of what it addresses, so that it paints a world that has many needs and confronts us with many risks and vulnerabilities and problems, and here's generally the stance we're going to take to address them. And it's arguable that that's not really a strategy at all, but rather a general statement of what we're about in the world. And I think that's an important distinction to make here.
Michael Vlahos is a professor of history at the U.S. Naval War College. His views are his own. Michael, this is the second national security strategy that President Obama's released. His last one was in 2010, and obviously the world is much different today than it was then. The themes, though, in this strategy seem to be very similar. Is that a fair derivation on my part?
Yeah, absolutely. Because the president typically has or if he doesn't have, will soon find a way to get a larger vision of what he wants to do in the world as leader of the great world power, and the document will essentially reflect what that vision is. And typically, for quite a while, I mean, this goes back really to the post-World War II era, the U.S. broad vision has been to promote a world order in which democratic values and free markets will be nurtured and expanded. After the Cold War, of course, it seemed as though this goal had been achieved in the sense that the world would now be underwritten solely by the United States, and that the inherent conflict that the Soviet Union posed between two rival superpowers had gone away. In the recent Bush 2 era of George W. Bush in the global war on terror, the national security strategy was heavily overshadowed by the urgency of a new world crisis in the eyes of the administration then. And when President Obama came into office, he had a very clear alternative approach to world dynamics, and he laid out, as he had promised in his 2008 campaign, a very different way ahead in which the U.S. would not be engaged in the world from a crisis standpoint, and would instead seek to manage world affairs from a more discreet distance. And he has tried to pursue that. And it's interesting how this document has given rise to a lot of concern that he isn't, in fact, addressing the very urgent developments in the world that have arisen in the last year, at least, and are now intertwining in very worrisome ways. And if it doesn't yet amount to a world crisis, it's quite arguable that the situation in the world today does not benefit from this kind of anodyne, vanilla, candide-like description of what America is doing. I mean, it's great to talk about, for example, empowering civil society and young leaders, living our values, et cetera, advancing our energy security, lead in this, lead in that, seek stability here, invest here. That sounds great, but it sounds like the description of some happy, best of all possible worlds that is preserved in its state of bliss by this beneficent U.S. Stewardship. And the world today, quite frankly, looks very troubling, especially with events of the last couple weeks in mind.
Mike, the Washington Post had an interesting comparison between the last time we issued a national security strategy and this one. Referring to the 2010 NSS, the Post writes, it was released nearly a year before the beginning of the Arab Spring. It outlined non-proliferation goals that didn't anticipate the rising conflict with Russia. It didn't predict Ebola or Edward Snowden and revelations about global surveillance. And that's all understandable. I don't think it would be reasonable for anyone in hindsight to expect that any or all of these things would have been predicted in a national security strategy. And so that, I guess, brings me to the point of what do we do with this if we can expect to look back in 2 or 3 or 5 years and say, well, the challenges that we're facing in 2018 or 2020 or 2022 weren't predicted in this and weren't accounted for, and thus didn't really give us an opportunity to prepare for them?
Well, those are really trenchant points. And you might make the comparison to a document that might have been released in 2000 at the very end of the second Clinton administration, because I think you would have seen the same kind of mix of let's maintain the good things that are happening in the world and help improve the world scene for everyone who lives on this planet, while at the same time ignoring what was clearly a growing threat from insurgent groups like Al-Qaeda in 2000, and also looming problems in the former Soviet Union and the beginnings of strains between the United States and China. And those three areas of concern today, namely the former Soviet Union, China, and the place we call the Middle East, are really in situations that range from complete chaos and crisis to a disturbing possibility of big confrontation in the near term. And here I'm talking about the South China Seas. And the situation with Russia is the worst it's been, arguably, since before Gorbachev took power. I mean, a situation that strikes me, at least, as having the risks and catastrophic possibilities that we associated with the Cold War and its last flare-ups in the early 1980s. And that's really quite worrisome.
Mike, that takes me then to the next question, which is, if we're so bad at predicting the future, why do we keep predicting the future?
Well, in many ways, it's a confidence racket, because we're not really predicting. We all know we can't predict the future. What we're doing is laying down the authority of our confidence that things are going to be all right. In other words, there's much more of an assurance game going on in this document than any sort of rigorous strategic assessment. The purpose of the document is not only to reflect the president's vision, as I had said, but it's also to allay fears and worries that the U.S. will not be able to successfully discharge its responsibilities in terms of world management. And these documents really make a tremendous effort to downplay the very kind of crisis dynamics that may be emerging. Because the last thing the U.S. government wants to do is to inflame a crisis, maybe even push it over the edge, by acknowledging that crisis actually exists. And it's a real disservice in the end, because what it does is it, first of all, gives the impression that we're not on top of what's going on, and that actually undercuts the very confidence that the report is trying to generate. But at the same time, it gives the impression that that things are all right, and I think that's a mistake in a situation where things are not all right. And I think it's wonderful to offer reassurance to our allies and to Americans, but it's a mistake for us to appear to be avoiding or sidestepping or even denying really quite troubling developments in the world. And so I would have seen this report from the president's perspective a little differently. I would have, you know, advised a very serious strategic assessment that takes into account the possibility of things heading south in terms of world order, and creating a greater awareness that simply because there's no reified grand threat like the Soviet Union of yore, that the world system itself is not something that a lot of happy rhetoric will preserve indefinitely, and that it's going to be put under great stress from time to time, and that we should own up to that when we can see it, you know, staring us in the face.